Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM HD1 Evanston, Chicago. I'm Neha Yadavali, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, analyzing restaurant closures, the peak in deportations, an analysis of study habits in tween fashion, and a sports report. Those stories and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is WNUR News at 6. With only a week and a half until the Pete's location in Evanston is set to shut down, Sahana Ani asked students about their feelings regarding the recent flood of restaurant closures.
The Evanston food scene has taken a hit this year. First, Bob's Pizza closed down, then Chili's, and now Pete's has suddenly been set to close by the end of this month. Northwestern students are mourning the loss of these beloved locations.
As you may know, many Evanston restaurants have closed down. So I was just kind of wondering, what are your feelings about this?
I'm definitely the most sad about Pete's. It's just because I've gone them like very numerous times, maybe like dozens of times throughout freshman year, sophomore year. It's definitely the most accessible like Evanston study spot. I enjoy their drinks, and there's this one friend that I would always go to Pete's with, just as like a weekly or like bi-weekly thing, you know, every Saturday or so. I just think it's like a great like community space, and it's just so sad. I can't believe it's closing.
Well, some are thinking of the memories they've made.
Well, I personally am extremely devastated about Chili's closing. It was the first restaurant I went to with my parents when we like moved me into Northwestern. Day one, we went to Chili's and it was awesome. And I have since been with my friends many times since being here, and it has become a staple of my life at Northwestern. And I just think Chili's is a great restaurant. And I'm really, really sad that it closed.
I'm really sad that Bob's is closing. I would go at least once a month for trivia with my friends, and it was like a big part of also how like my Model UN team would bond, and I'm gonna really miss it.
When I was, I guess, inducted into Buushaga this year, as a freshman, they all kidnapped us and took us to Chili's and got us Chili's. So that was a great experience, and so I'm sad that Chili's was closed.
Others will miss the convenience.
I have noticed that it seems like a lot of places are closing down temporarily or permanently, but I definitely like think Pete's is going to be the one that it has the biggest effect on my life because it's such a big study spot. Like, it's one of the few coffee shops that get a lot of like student traffic, so I guess I'm just like a little bit worried that it's gonna be gone.
I'm very sad that Chili's is closing. I think it's a great place to hang out with friends, and you can get cheap food, watch sports, have fun. And I feel like we don't have many places like that in Evanston.
When Chili's closed, we were very, very distraught. I think it was a very nice, like, neighborhood place that brought a lot of, like, students together for, like, celebratory things, even to just, like, casual lunch and catching up with friends. So it was really disheartening to see it close down.
And many students are just left with questions.
Just wondering like why everything seems to be closing all at once.
I heard that there was a guy who started a petition that has a few hundred signatures, I think, to stop Pete's from closing. Like, they're petitioning to the company because there are a lot of people who work there who mean a lot to the community, and they don't want to see them get laid off.
And I feel like it's not even like doing bad either. It's been doing great. So it was very like unexpected, this news.
For WNUR News, Sahana Ani.
Wonder why your favorite Disney Channel star's outfits looked a little crazy? Dive into the vibrant world of 2000s Disney fashion with reporter Kara Totley, where colorful outfits weren't just style choices, but a part of a carefully crafted formula.
The 2000s tween's fashion was marked with an abundance of color, mismatched print, fur, sequins, and lots of layering. Even though some outfits may have been better than others, there was one particular studio that was pumping out some of the most iconic 2000s looks. That studio is none other than Disney. In the 2000s and early 10s, Disney had a variety of shows that gave us fashion icons like Hannah Montana, Lizzie McGuire, Raven Baxter, and London Dipton. Sometimes the fashion choices worked, and sometimes it didn't.
I've definitely, you know, seen, like, clips from Shake It Up where I kind of cringe a bit. But I I also give myself grace because, you know, that it was the trends of the time.
That was Jessica Raplansky. Raplansky was the costume designer for multiple Disney Channel shows, including Shaken Up and Austin and Ally.
The aesthetic I kind of developed on that show was very, like, layered, which I thought was very interesting. But so we were layering a lot of different clothes. Like, so even if, like, one of the actors was wearing a crop top, they would have, like, another top, like a tank top underneath, but we made it in a way that looked, like, cool and part of the style.
This aesthetic is so identifiable that people are now poking fun at the style on TikTok. Katherine Wagner, a former costume designer for Disney who worked on some of their more popular shows, told Vogue about the importance of color in a show's wardrobe. At the time, live-action shows were essentially competing with cartoons for the attention of children. Hence, Wagner chose to utilize brighter colors when styling Disney actors. But in a way, it worked. Disney Channel was at its peak popularity between 2010 and 2015, with shows like Wizards of Waverly Place, Jonas, Shake It Up, Hannah Montana, and many more. According to Statista, the channel averaged about 1.96 million viewers in 2014. Thus, the clothes became part of a formula in crafting a Disney show.
Disney was very, you know, they had very strict rules about what was appropriate to show for girls, or, I mean, kids in general, but I feel like specifically girls. And so, yes, we definitely had to be very mindful of, like, not showing too much midriff, making sure the skirts weren't too short, heeled and all that.
Which in hindsight makes sense. The bright and fun clothes matched the mindset of a tween picking out an outfit during that time. It was also an age-appropriate version of the trends happening in the women's fashion scene, such as the miniskirt, which explains the love for the jeans or the leggings under the skirts. Adding a bit of modesty to protect the young actors who at the time were working at ages ranging from 12 to 14. However, sticking to this formula doesn't allow for the actors' clothing to mature with them. Thus, at the age of 18, actors had to adhere to the same modesty standards that they had as a tween, especially since the outfit standards weren't constricted to their on-screen characters, but also to the actors' personal lives, highlighting another aspect that contributed to the standards of Disney: purity culture.
By the 1990s, there is a large-scale cultural fear around sex. And it was a couple of things. One, you have the HIV/AIDS crisis. The other thing that was perceived as a problem in the 80s and 90s was teen pregnancy. And so both of those things together created a real fear.
That was Dr. Sarah Mosliner, faculty at Central Michigan University in the Department of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Religion. Dr. Mosliner has been studying evangelic purity culture for almost 15 years.
The SBC started to threaten to boycott both Disney and ABC. They had millions of people who just, you know, stopped going to Disney and were, like, committed to boycotting because it was this family values issue. And especially Disney, which is supposed to be this family-friendly place, right? They were changing the definition of family that the SBC was and other evangelical Christians and other conservative Christians were not willing to accept.
The SBC stands for the Southern Baptist Convention, and at the time, they were gaining more power as Disney started to lose money. So Disney began to buckle.
Disney, you know, shifted, was very much influenced by the SBC and purity culture, and under pressure, embraced this as a way to market their young stars.
One of those marketing strategies was purity rings. Almost every Disney actor in the 2000s wore purity rings, and Disney was able to use their stars proclaiming their chastity as a way to create a new wave of profitable teen stars. Joe Jonas told James Corden during Carpool Karaoke,
"The next thing you know is the Jonas Brothers and their purity rings." And that was like what people ran with forever. That was a running joke. And we found the humor at sometimes, but of course, we just kind of decided at one point, we're like, look, this is not who we are.
Purity rings became a part of the Jonas Brothers' identity. Nick Jonas shed more light on his feelings about the way the media discussed the rings in an interview with Harper's Bazaar, saying, quote, "The question should have been, is it appropriate for people to talk about a 16-year-old sex life? It's absolutely not. And it wouldn't necessarily fly today," end quote.
Going back to fashion, Disney's commitment to a vivid and playful wardrobe wasn't merely a strategic move to capture the audience's attention. It was intricately woven into the fabric of modesty standards. They incorporated layers and vibrant colors into the prevailing fashion of the time, as the primary trends of the 2000s were deemed too scandalous to align with Disney's family-friendly image.
Berklansky suggests a more individualistic approach to style, emphasizing the importance of personal comfort and aesthetic appeal.
Person sticks to their, like, what works for them and their body and, like, what they are just drawn to aesthetically, then their style will be good.
For WNUR News, I'm Cara Totley.
Have you ever wondered how the person next to you in Maine is able to stay focused? Gabby Schell set out to find some answers last year.
It's week 5 at Northwestern, which means, let's be real, we're on week 3 of our painfully staggered, never-ending midterm season. Maybe you're holding up in mud for the first time this quarter. Maybe you're finishing up your first round of midterms, ready to hang out with your friends just to find they're nowhere in sight. Wherever you are, whatever you're up to, there's always one thing to turn to. Music. Instead of feeling stressed, depressed, and alone as we trudge through our way through the slog of exams, papers, and stories, we decided to focus on what unites us. Here's a look into the inner ears of our Northwestern students as they lock in and listen up this fall.
Crazy, but it's like a mixture of hip-hop, like funk, fusion, like psychedelic rock, and whatever, random stuff.
That was McCormick freshman Shay Smith. For him, there's no method to the music madness. It's all vibes. Weinberg freshman Sachin Chawla had a similar vibes-based approach to studying, admittedly with less variety.
Drake's my favorite artist of all time for everything.
Although both Smith and Chawla were more inclined to study to their favorite songs, they also shared the same caveat.
If I'm studying something that I have to read, like Spanish language, I'll listen to something like softer that usually no lyrics, like classical. I like Pokemon music. I don't know if you heard. It's very good.
If I'm reading something, then I probably don't want to, like, that would be more prone to use, like, classical, because sometimes lyrics can interfere with, like, reading.
While listening to classical music may seem less fun than more modern songs, there is a scientific reason to do so. According to a study published in Learning and Individual Differences, students who listen to classical music while they study tend to perform better on exams than students who don't. Chawla has seen the benefits of this.
I think it does help me listen and kind of comprehend more, because then I associate, you know, the two, like the song and what I'm studying, and it helps me remember it.
But for some students, just listening to music in the background doesn't quite do the trick. McCormick senior Fatima Almanjar has a tried and true study hack: screaming lyrics at the top of her lungs.
I overthink, and then if I don't hear music, then and I'm working, I will think of something else, so I would rather be singing the song while working.
Her current favorite scream song? A 15-minute long Iraqi song called Ana Walila, a ballad about the singer's lover, Lila, who left him for a richer man.
Well, every time he screams, I'm screaming, I'm like doing my math. Everything, I'm like, yes. Differentiation.
Whether scream singing, shuffling liked songs, or putting on Mozart's Requiem in D minor, most students agreed music was crucial to getting in the grind set. But as a good stats major would tell you, in every dubiously collected set of data, there's an outlier.
When, like, it comes to times where I have to lock in, I listen to comedy specials.
That was McCormick freshman Diego Figueroa. Unlike some students who have an anything-goes approach to study music, he has a carefully calibrated system.
When I was in high school, for to do math homework, I would listen to heavy metal. And then when I would have to do, like, science, I would put on something like Alex G. But when midterms or finals come around, comedy is always the way to go.
His favorite special, Safety Patrol of Life by Davis Williamson. Always a guaranteed laugh.
The first day of fifth grade safety patrols.
And if anybody, I listen to those jokes. Like, I laugh sometimes, but, you know, it's just better.
Last or not, joy was a central factor for students when choosing what to add to their queue.
I listen to basically anything that will lift me up so I don't feel depressed studying.
It just makes me like happier and thus more likely to do my work.
Maybe that's the key. Instead of maximizing our productive output, we should focus on finding something to listen to that keeps the load light and maybe, just maybe, helps us find some joy. For WNUR News, I'm Tilly Freed.
As winter marches on, some Northwestern teams have faltered. However, new sports have also just begun. Gabe Shumway has the highs and lows in this week's sports report.
Hello, I'm Gabe Shumway here with your NU Sports Report on everything from this past week. The number 6-ranked fencing team was back in action in Medford, Massachusetts over the weekend to tackle the Tufts Invitational. 4 matches for the Cats, 4 wins. They took down Wellesley and Tufts in dominant fashion, closed out a 16-11 win over Brown, and eked out a 14-13 squeaker against number 12 Cornell. Foilists were especially dominant for Northwestern, with Brianna Ho and Samantha Serbin combining for an impeccable 14-0 record. It was a 1-1 week for women's basketball. In the lone home contest of the week, the Wildcats defeated the Wisconsin Badgers 66-61. Coming just shy of another double-double, Caroline Lau dropped 15 points with 9 assists to boot. Grace Sullivan was once again Grace Sullivan, showing that even on an off day, she could score 19 points and lead the team. When the Cats went to number 25 Illinois over the weekend, however, it was a different story. A narrow 74-71 loss soured the Wildcats' 2-game run. The bright spots in this one were once again Grace Sullivan, who scored 21 on 10-for-22 shooting, and Zamaya Walton, who netted a career-high 19. The Cats have a tough road ahead, however, with 3 of their next 5 opponents being ranked teams, including number 3 UCLA and number 7 Michigan. Tennis season has begun in Evanston, with both the men's and women's teams having 3 matches each last week. The women's side finishes with an unblemished 3-0 record, defeating 2 current and 1 former Atlantic 10 team. The first of the trio of wins came against VCU. Northwestern was off to the races in this one, boat racing the Rams 7-0. The only loss for Northwestern came in the number 1 doubles, where Mika Dagon-Fruchtman and Nina Feldman fell to VCU. In the second match against Temple, the Cats did one better, once again sweeping the singles 6-0 and winning 2-0 in doubles, with one match remaining unfinished. Finally, in the ultimate showing of the 3, the Cats showed their humanity. By this, I mean they surrendered 1 point to Richmond, still winning 6-1. The men's team, however, suffered a different fate, finishing 1-2 in their 3 matches. The first of these saw the Cats face off with Vanderbilt, losing 6-1 in the Combe Tennis Center. The lone victory in that matchup came from sophomore Carter Pate. After that came Louisville, where the Cats fell 4-1 after a pair of unfinished matches. Cyrus Majoub took home the Wildcats' only win that time. Finally, Northwestern entered the win column Sunday when Youngstown State came to Evanston. The Wildcats recorded a 4-0 win in that match on the back of 2 more Carter Pate victories in both singles and doubles. That wraps up your NU Sports Report for this week. For more information about upcoming games, as well as how you can watch the Wildcats live, visit www.nusports.com. I'm Dave Shumway for WNUR News.
Taking a look into the headlines in Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. In Evanston, the Starbucks at Dumpster and Dodge has reopened part-time after a barista strike, but it remains unclear who is staffing it, as the union says the strike is unresolved and may involve illegal replacement of workers, while Starbucks maintains the store is still ununionized. In Chicago news, Chicago City Council voted to ban most hemp-derived products ahead of a federal ban in order to protect minors from unregulated intoxicants, while allowing limited exceptions for hemp beverages, CBD products, and pet items, despite concerns that the measure could hurt small businesses and face a potential mayoral veto. In national news, Ford is recalling about 119,000 vehicles due to defective engine block heaters that can crack, leak coolant, and cause fires risk when plugged in. And owners are advised to stop using them until a free fix is available. Scientists have filmed rare seagrass fairy circles in Scotland's Outer Hebrides, highlighting both the dramatic long-term decline of seagrass due to disease and human activity and new hope for recovery through conservation and restoration efforts. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 893. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Ethan Pan, and our reporters are Sahana Ani, Kara Totley, Gabe Shumway, and Gabby Shell. I'm Neha Yadavali. Catch our next newscast Friday, January 23rd. Now, back to scheduled programming.